Well, it's my pleasure to introduce the next speaker. The next speaker is Nancy Hess. She's coming from the Environmental Molecular Sciences Laboratory at Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, and Nancy is one of the leading scientists that we have at PNNL in research related to the carbon dynamic in soils. Nancy?
Thanks, Nick. First, I want to thank the organizers for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to have an opportunity to talk to you about the research that we're doing here and actually trying to understand the processes that drive the soil carbon using high-resolution mass spectrometry. I also like to thank my co-authors on this. I have two wonderful postdocs, Malak Tafali and Kristen Lascoli, as well as many technical folks at PNNL, as well as our science leads for mass spectrometry, Liliana Pasatolik and Robbie Robinson. Really, without them, there would be no presentation here. So, as Nick mentioned, MSOL is a user facility. It's located in Richland, Washington. It is funded by the DOE Office of Science and the Biological and Environmental Research Program there. Its goal really is to provide molecular discovery in the areas of biology, energy, and the environment to support the needs of DOE and the nation. And I'll talk more about access at the very end of my talk if I have time. So we've heard a lot this morning and this afternoon about the problem of the net increase of CO2 in the atmosphere. And I just love this picture. It came out several years ago, probably almost a decade or more now. But it really shows that what we see in the atmosphere is a result of very large fluxes of CO2 being incorporated by plants through photosynthetic processes and microorganisms in the ocean being uptaken in those media, but then being respired back out. So I kind of think of the land ocean almost as lungs, right? They're breathing. And it's a very dynamic system, but the fact of whether these organs will be a net uptake or a source of CO2 in the future is a balance of a lot of very dynamic processes. So it's upsetting that balance that will determine whether we have a net uptake or decrease of CO2 in the soils. So if we look at the models, and again, this is based on an older generation of the IUPCC, we can see that the course is going to be more CO2 in the atmosphere in the future. All models agree in that aspect. There's some spread in the amount, specifically, especially at the end of the decade. We all see that oceans will be a net uptake, will increase. Again, the amount of disagreement by these models is relatively small, but when you look at land, the variability in these models is about four times as large, and in fact, it's not clear whether land will be a net source or sink, and so that is a real problem in terms of trying to come up with robust predictions of what's happening in the future. So in from the point of view of me personally, is that a lot of this uncertainty is driven by the fact that these models don't really have a good mechanistic understanding of the processes that end up storing carbon below ground. The mechanisms are not well studied, and the models really lack that mechanistic detail. I think a good approach for moving forward, and this is sort of maybe getting to some of the comments that the organizers asked us to provide, I think that we really need a more holistic model of these processes that look at carbon allocation as a sum of root plant inputs, the microbes, fungal communities, soil organic matter, the biogeochemistry, and the hydrology is critically important. And until we're able to encapsulate our thinking in this larger holistic process, I think that we're going to have problems moving forward. That, and then we have to figure out how the carbon is linked to other metabolic pathways that involve nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur. And to me, a good starting point is to develop some greater skill at doing molecular characterization of soil carbon. And by being able to look at the molecular process characterization of soil, to really look for footprints of these processes in the soils that we have there. And so that's what I'm hoping to show you today. So we've developed a soft extraction approach based on polar solvents, and we've heard some explanations today on why polar solvents are particularly good at extracting soil organic matter from soils. We've looked at three solvents here. They vary in their polarity, and sure enough that we find that when we use these solvents to look at a standard, and this is the Suwannee River fulvic acid, that they are slightly biased in their extraction of organic matter, and we're using that to our advantage in this case. And so if we look at more detail, we can see that methanol tends to extract organic matter that's richer in saturation, whereas something as acetonitrile, which is a little bit more polar, extracts compounds with a higher oxygen compound content or lower hydrogen. Now, maybe you didn't notice, but when we use methanol or acetonitrile, we're extracting thousands of organic molecules that we can assign to molecular formula, and it's really hard in some cases to wrap your head around what all that information is trying to tell you. So we use a representation called a Van Creveland diagram to get a better handle of what these compounds are and to put them into a conceptual framework that we're more familiar with. So plotted here on the x-axis is the oxygen-to-carbon ratio, and on the y is the hydrogen-to-carbon ratio. And you can see groups that we're more familiar with, like lipids, lignans, and proteins, all occupy different regions of this space. So when we look at the impact of these solvents on these Van Creveland diagrams, we can see that hexane, which is the least polar, is great at getting lipids, but it will not extract things like the tannins and lignans. So again, this can be used to help you in mass spectrometry, because then you have less competition for ionization, and it's a good thing. And you can see the comparison, acetonitrile in green and methanol in yellow, that they're extracting pretty similar types of compounds, and that's because their polarity is very similar indeed. However, we do see differences. If this next plot over here is showing the compounds that are only extracted by one of those solvents. And just as we had hypothesized, the acetonitrile is extracting those compounds with a higher oxygen content. And so what we've come up with then is a strategy where we actually use a variety of solvents on the same sample to get a better representation of the types of organic molecules that are actually present in these samples. And so here's again the Suwannee River fulvic acid with a composite of the hexane, methanol, and acetonitrile solvents in it. Well, that's all well and good, but how does that really work on soils? And so we did. We looked at, so far, 13 actually many more, but 13 soil samples from a variety of ecosystems from across the U.S. And what I'm showing you here is the result of two highly contrasting soils, a peat from northern Minnesota and a sand, a riverbed from the Columbia River in Washington. And what you can see pretty dramatically is that the peat has a lot more lignin and condensed hydrocarbons in it, whereas the riverbed is pretty much full of lipids. And these are just, again, the different colors to show you the extraction of methanol versus acetonitrile in this case. And so this is all well and good, but these are looking at a contrast between very different soils. What if we were to look at the same soil pre- and post-incubation? So these samples are from Scott Bridgman. He's been looking at a plot system where he has sort of a control, which is what we're looking at, and then he has a double litter and a no litter control, but I'm not going to show those data. So he's shown on the left here is pre-incubation, and on the right, post-incubation, and of the control here at 25 degrees for about a year. And actually, it's hard to say that there's really much difference when you look at this plot. The color in this case indicates the mass of the organic compounds. So the red and yellows signify higher mass units, and the bluer colors low mass. There might be a small, visible in the scale, a small decrease in the mass of some of the lipid portion, but it's hard to tell. But there's a better way of representing that data, and that's to look at the relative abundance. Again, we're classifying all those dots into these sort of conceptual model lipids, unsaturated hydrocarbons, and proteins. And shown in light blue, pre-incubation, you can see we have high lipid content, protein, and unsaturated hydrocarbons, but after incubation, that fraction falls down, and we get a relative increase in the lignin and tannins and condensed hydrocarbons. And this sort of also is reassuring to some conceptual models that say that those types of compounds are hard for microbes to respire. So this type of result is not surprising, that you get a relative decrease in those more tasty organic molecules. So another experiment we did, this is with Vanessa Bailey at PNNL, and these are pore waters extracted from cores, and these are cores from the Disney Wilderness Preserve in Florida, and what we're looking at is a palmetto, the soils beneath a palmetto forest area. And shown in the gray bars there are then the vacuum pressure that was used to extract these pore waters, and we're seeing a change in the makeup of the dissolved organic matter that's included in those pores. And you can see it at the larger pores being extracted at the lower vacuum pressures actually have a greater diversity of organic molecules in them, seem to have more organic molecules in them. We haven't proceeded much beyond this very quick look at this stage, but it does give rise to this concept that there is a spatial organization of the organic matter in these pore soil pores. So I think that's very exciting indications. So now delving into a little bit more detail about what we can really extract, how we can really utilize this high-resolution mass spectrometry data is another project I've been working on with Julie Jastrow from Argonne Lab in partnership with Alex Laskin and EMSL. And these are actually silts, soil organic matter associated with silt. And what we're looking at are soils from the Fermi plots out by Argonne, and it's a corona sequence from a remnant prairie, long-term agricultural field, and then not shown here, but also in this analysis, we have intermediate restored agricultural fields. So again, we get the high-resolution mass spectrometry data. Instead of binning them into lipids and proteins and lignins, we're now looking at their chemical composition. So we've assigned a molecular formula to them, and shown in blue are just those organic molecules that are oxygenated. They don't have sulfur, nitrogen, or phosphorus associated with them. Those are shown in the orange, green, and pink color. And when you look at the remnant prairie compared to the long-term agricultural field, we can see that there's a large abundance of these oxygenated hydrocarbons that are not present in the long-term agricultural field. And in fact, that is enriched in sulfur-containing hydrocarbons instead. So that's kind of interesting and not necessarily a result that you would be able to obtain from a bulk analysis of the soil or even some pyrolysis methods. Shown on the right-hand side is something called a Kendrick clot, and these are not nearly as intuitive as the Kendrick, Van Creveland diagrams. And along the x-axis here, we have mass increasing in this direction. And then what we have on the y-axis is something called a Kendrick defect mass. And these are for the alkane group CH2. So along the horizontal line, what we have is an organic molecule like this, and each dot represents the inclusion of a CH2 group. So we have these long alkane chains here. And starting at the top, you have relatively simple carboxylate groups, and as you go down higher mass defect, you have greater degrees of saturation, so more complex carbon bonding. What's really remarkable when you compare the remnant prairie to the long-term agricultural field is you can see these long chains are completely missing in the long-term agricultural field. This type of insight you could only get using the mass spectrometry data at a very high resolution. And it kind of makes you think, what kind of processes could be operating that would selectively remove these kinds of fragments? And so that was exactly what we asked. And shown here now, this is a blow up of that Kendrick plot. And what I've included now is both very small fragments of these nitrogen containing compounds and then phosphorus and sulfur. If we just isolate one series here, we can actually see that we have the exact type of organic compounds here represented in the oxygenated fragment, as we do in the phosphorus group and the sulfate group. So we have a 9 carbon chain, 29 carbons, 42 carbons, not quite shown correlating down there. So what they suggest is that we have some mechanism that's relating these pools of carbon atoms to each other. And we did this, again, for all the compounds in there, and this is a plot here then of the number of carbon atoms in the chain versus the relative percentage, and we can see that the distribution of oxygenated hydrocarbons, those with sulfur and phosphate, more or less follow the same pattern. And again, that is suggesting that we may have some sort of process that's resulting in the hydrolysis of essentially these esters off of these long alkane chains. And it may be the result of some biological activity like a sulfatase or a phosphatase. So by using this high-resolution mass spectrometry, we're actually seeing sort of footprints of these biological processes in the data. And this is very exciting, and we're very interested in correlating this then with enzyme activity information, microbial genomic information, to see if these relationships hold up when integrated with a larger data set. We've also looked at this in a more abiotic system. This is looking at ashes as a result of the fires at Yosemite last year, the Rim Fire. And of course, there's a lot of interest into how fires affect water qualities for the watersheds that are dependent on these communities are dependent on these watersheds, and what kind of organic molecules that are formed as a result of fire and how that might be impacting water quality. So again, this plot isn't necessarily too intuitive. We have carbon number, very similar to what I showed you on that earlier plot, but this time we're plotting the degree of saturation. DBE stands for double bond equivalency. And what we're seeing is that the white ash is more saturated than the black ash. That's already a little bit of controversy, but very exciting. And if actually we then sort of rebin it into our more familiar classification scheme, we can see that we get a big pink wedge here that actually corresponds to the saturated hydrocarbons when you look at the distribution of these organic molecules. So if we turn back to our friend now, the Kendrick diagram, and this is now, instead of using alkene groups, we're looking at carboxylate groups. And along a horizontal line, then, we're adding different number of carboxylate groups to it. But if we go up along the diagonal, we're actually adding nitrogen into these tetrazine molecules. And this little purple line shows a hydrolysis reaction. So yet again, in the more biotic sense, we're finding chemical relationships between the organic molecules that are present in these soils. And again, this is just another great opportunity where we can start piecing together the processes that might be driving the carbon dynamics. And so that's very exciting for us. So what I've shown you today is just a very small segment of the types of expertise and capabilities that are present at EMSL. We have sort of just looked at the mass spec portion of organic matter characterization. We also have tremendous capabilities in NMR and other spectroscopies. We have expertise that spans these spatial scales, looking at everything from electron transfer reactions, omics approaches to microbial communities, pore scale, looking at the impact of hydrology and pore scale hydration on these processes, as well as tomography, looking at root structure. So I should also say that access to EMSL is through a proposal process. It's all online. The great thing is that it's free if you go through peer review. And there's three different mechanisms by which you can become a user. And if you have any questions at all, please come up and ask me. So I think I'm wrapping up pretty quickly here. Awesome. So, yeah. I want to acknowledge all the users that we used their data in this presentation from a variety of institutions, and it's a great thrill to be able to work with your colleagues here. But I also want to thank our funding agency, again, DOE's Office of Science and the Biological Environmental Research Program. So with that, we'll take whatever questions.
We have time for questions. We have 3 minutes for questions. I like the idea of free. I heard free and I'm like, okay, so yeah. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, yeah, as long as you're willing to publish, and we strongly encourage that you do.
Yeah, of course.
It is without cost, and we can't pay for your travel or support of your students or whatnot, but in terms of the staff time and access to the equipment, that's all paid for by DOE.
Great.
Isn't there a spatial organization of organ compounds in this old stage? What determines that? What could be next to particles or to the center?
Yeah, so the example I showed you was a little bit different than that. We were meaning spatial organization, whereas different size pores seem to have different types of organic matter in them. Yeah. That I don't know that we've been able to, we haven't looked at the data in that way. That would be very interesting. Because the pores are on the scale of several microns, I don't know that the size of the molecule would be a strong determinant. But we're very interested in trying to figure out the types of molecules that are present. Larger pores, hopefully being more, have more pore fluid movement, and you might have more dissolved organic, soluble components in those. But we need to go back and really determine whether that thought is validated by the data.
Any more comments or questions? Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you.